we are dealing with attitudes of racism that we may harbor, consciously or unconsciously, this week. We have defined racism, we have done some role-playing. Today, we're going to present, Suk is going to do most of the presentation today. We're going to present a case study about how racism and law are intertwined, for good or for ill. And the specific case is, as Suk will tell you, is about Chong Sun France, who's in prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, even as we speak. Before we get to that, I'd like to remind you that there are some a book that I've been using this week called For Whites Only is on sale in the bookstore at 20% off. And another book by Richard Wright, who's a gifted black writer, is also on sale. So,
thank you. Chong Sun France is a Korean American woman, although she has a Caucasian, not Caucasian, but a Western last name. You will know why she got that name. She was born in South Korea in 1960. So she is like 32 now, and serving 20-year sentence. Seems like a life sentence to me. In the Raleigh Correctional Institute for Women. In order to understand her case, I want to bring up her background in Korea and her marriage and all. She grew up in the rural Korea, so-called Pyeongtaek. I don't know if you are familiar with Korean geography. It's about 1 hour south, or 2 hours south from Seoul. Seoul is the capital of South Korea. It's a rather small town, probably 80,000 population. Her mother was a second wife, which means concubine in South Korea, or in Korea, in Confucian society. If you are a second wife, you cannot worship together with the rest of the family. You are regarded as a second-class citizen. So it has very serious moral implications. And her father died when she was 11. So obviously she was very loved by her father. So when her father died when she was 11, she was emotionally broken up. Not necessarily emotionally broken up, but also her father's death made a significant difference in her life later on. After her father died, her brother, I believe he has only one biological brother, and five stepsisters and brothers. Her brother had to stop his schooling, of course, to support his mother and sister. At that time, Korean government paid education up to sixth grade. I believe still it is true in Korea, either sixth grade or ninth grade. In some parts, I think the government pays up to ninth grade, and then in some other parts, probably sixth grade. Her brother had to support the whole family, which was her mother and her, and then himself. He learned construction work and got a job, but it was extremely difficult for the young teenager to support the whole family. So he wrote, he kept a diary, and Chongsan happened to see his diary as written, I'd rather commit suicide since it's so difficult for me to support the whole family. I'd rather commit suicide. Chongsan saw it, and she thought, well, I need to do something about this, because I'm old enough to understand this conflict problem. So she, as soon as she graduated sixth grade, she got a job. She went out and became a housemaid and also worker in a factory and getting paid minimum wage. It didn't work out, or she thought she could do better. She's very intelligent, and she's not educated, but her IQ seems to be high, so she can analyze things quite well. And so she thought, I need to break this cycle by going to the military, U.S. military base. We still have 36,000 U.S. soldiers in Korea. And at the time, I believe we had more. I think currently we have minimum number of military personnel. And so she was hoping to meet a nice U.S. soldier to marry, and then come to the United States and have a new life. And she thought she could possibly work here, make enough money to support her Korean family, her mother and brother. That's what she did, but her fortune didn't cooperate. When she met this U.S. soldier called Danny Franz and brought him to her home to introduce him to her brother. In Korean Confucian system, sons are very, very important. Women or girls are supposed to have three masters in their lives. When they are young, their fathers are the masters. When they are married, husband. And when they are old, the sons will be their masters. So she, legally as well as socially, her brother was her master because her father died when she was young. Instead of her mother. When she brought him to her brother, Mr. Danny Franz said, her brother was not in favor of her going to the United States with this man and make money, and I don't know if she said to her brother explicitly she was going to make money and support him or something like that. But anyway, her brother was very against of her marriage. But Danny Franz said, if you don't let us go to the United States, I'm going to shoot him. I'm going to shoot you. So her brother was forced to support their journey to the United States and ended up paying Danny Francis dead in the U.S. military base, like $2,000, which was significant. I mean, large amount of money at the time, like in 1980. She came to the United States when she was 19, I believe, right end of 1979 or beginning 1980. She came to the United States with him. As a wife, but I don't know how many of you have lived in overseas. It is extremely difficult to live in a foreign country without knowing the culture and especially the language itself. I assume having her education only sixth grade, she couldn't have possibly understood U.S. culture nor the language very well either. So the marriage didn't work out, of course not. The marriage broke, and she had a child, a daughter, Lisa. She lost custody for some reason. I believe she ended up working in a factory and had to hire a babysitter. And she could, her husband was very abusive. He was drug addict, and she has been very, very abused from just from the beginning. And so the marriage broke up, and she started seeing another man in her church. She's a very devoted Christian, unbelievable, almost fanatic. She has very strange idea of Christianity. For example, she would say, if I died, I will meet God, or if I died, I will meet my child, all these strange ideas. She started seeing another man, Edmund. But he was also very, very abusive and heroin addict. And unfortunately, she had two children by him, Moses and Esther. Moses was 2.5 years old, and then Esther was 1.5 years old when this terrible incident happened. But Edmund, her boyfriend, was so abusive that she had to escape him with these two young children. She lived with him in Maryland, Aberdeen, Maryland, at the time. But one of her Korean girlfriends said, you could come to Jacksonville, where she was, Jacksonville, North Carolina, and find a job here and support your children here without being dependent on your boyfriend. So she ran away from her abusive boyfriend in March 1987. And 2 months later, this terrible incident happened. She would put these two children into bed around 6:30, and she would leave home to work in the bar for 4 hours while they would be sleeping. And plus, since she had been abused by Caucasian, both were Caucasian males. By Caucasian males, she had tremendous difficulty trusting anybody, or especially white people, because she had such bad experience by from these white folks, especially males. So she couldn't trust anybody to keep her children. And it was new environment, new place. And after reading the trial transcript, I realized why she could not trust the Caucasian males. When a couple of Caucasian men offered that they would keep an eye on them, she was operating by a strange idea that Caucasian males would have sex with babies, or I think one of her Caucasian male friends had that experience. So she couldn't trust Caucasian males. So she ended up leaving them unattended for more than 3 hours, 4 hours while she was working abroad at night. One night in May, it was May 27, 1987, she fed them and put them into bed as usual, went to work, and came back home only to find Moses to be crushed on the TV. The TV was on top of the metal chest of drawers in her motel room. And she noticed Moses used to step in one of the chest of drawers, second drawer, step in there and then play with TV buttons and dial. Obviously, she thought the TV must have toppled over, and then he got gradually fell down, and then metal chest of drawers was toppled over again on top of him, or I don't know how it has happened, but he was dead already when she came home at 1:30, 12 o'clock in the morning. She panicked, and she was very angry, because she knew it was illegal that she leaves these children unattended in this country. In Korea, everybody in the neighborhood keeps an eye on children when they are. It's like the holding community. We don't need to hire extra babysitter and pay. It's not usual. It is usual now, but while she was growing up, which was my generation, it is extremely different. And usually grandmothers and grandparents would take care of the children if mothers had jobs, which was also unusual. Mothers didn't have jobs in the time. But anyway, so it was... to her, it was culturally difficult to accept this new cultural standard or custom. At the same time, she could not afford paying, probably, I don't know how much they would charge in Jacksonville, North Carolina, $3, $4 per hour. She couldn't afford hiring a babysitter, and on top of that, she couldn't trust anybody at the time. So when she found out Moses was already dead, she thought she would escape with Esther, another child girl, Esther, because she was afraid of losing her again. So, but she couldn't stand the idea she would have to bury Moses under the ground and all this. So she called her former boyfriend. The telephone line was disconnected. So she was desperate, and she went to the owner of the bar who lived downstairs of the motel where she lived at the time. And he suggested she ought to call the police. So she called the police. It was already 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. When the police came, she was exhausted and she was hopeless. I mean, she thought, I lost my child and now I'm almost dead person or half dead or something like that. So she was not cooperative. To the police officers, and she was even rude. She couldn't understand why these police detectives would ask her constantly how she found Moses, or in what situation and all.
She had cleaned up the scene of the accident.
Right.
Put everything back in place.
Not knowing the legal procedure of this country, she cleaned up the scene.
There's glass pieces.
You know, she put everything back and she swept the room. In Korea, it is not fortunate to show messy room to your visitors. I mean, it's universal, I'm sure. But she thought, she felt ashamed to show this messy room to the visitors in that situation. So she cleaned up, swept and everything. Soon TV crew came and they recorded everything while she was yelling at the police officers and leave me alone, I killed him, it was all my fault. She even said that it was all my fault and I killed him. In Korea, we have the same expression in Korean, I killed him. If one of my family members, especially children, died, mothers, I would say, I killed him. It doesn't necessarily translate into I murdered him, but it translates I participated in the death. It is my fault, I'm humiliated. But that phrase, very phrase, I killed him, was taped, and it was used against her as a confession by the police detectives and the officers, other officers. So she was put in county jail for 7 months before the trial started. The trial lasted 5 days, and I read the transcript. It's about 600 pages, and her English was just incoherent. I couldn't even understand what she was talking about. She, according to the transcript, they asked if she needed a translator. She said she could talk. So they just ignored the fact that she needed a translator. And her English was very poor at the time.
The court recorder at the time wrote on a separate page that Chung Sun's English was very, very difficult to understand, with an underlining under the very, very. And so,
and one other cultural aspect, that she couldn't request a translator, even though she thought it might help, because it's not virtue to be assertive, for women to be assertive. Insisting for something, it's not virtue in Korean society. So she couldn't have asked for it, even though she thought it might help. So it was working against her. The trial lasted 5 days, and 80% of the time was spent by testimonies by two medical examiners and two city engineers who did reconstruction of that incident. And they couldn't figure it out, they couldn't match the markings of the child or the scars and the markings with the incident they reconstructed. If TV fell this way or 45-degree angle, it could have fell this part, could have hurt his backbone, or his, it went on and on. 80% of the time was spent.
It's forensics.
Yeah, in forensics. And they couldn't prove how the incident could have happened. But deliberately, the jury was led to believe that she could have killed her own son. So right before the Christmas, 87, she was convicted of second degree murder. It's not manslaughter. So she is serving 20 years in prison now, and she didn't have any supporters at that time, and her state-appointed lawyer tried to reduce the number of years she would serve, knowing that she served 5 or 7 months in county jail without being able to go outside a single time. And then she was threatened by the police officers during their time. And one of them would ask her, if you don't, I mean, she was so fed up by questions and all this. If you don't talk, I'm going to push you to the wall or something like that. Or one of the women police officers said, Chongsun was very rude to Caucasian mayors. But you came to the United States with one of them, didn't you? Just the deliberate aggressive remarks and so on. But it was not recognized by her state-appointed lawyer. The state-appointed lawyer said he had been serving in the court for 23 years. It was one of the most difficult cases he did. But he didn't have even opening remarks, no closing remarks. And then during the trial, it was very poorly done, and she was just trashed.
Railroaded. We call it railroaded.
Fresh.
And that was her defense attorney that you're talking about?
Right.
With no closing or opening remarks?
Right.
Mm-hmm. No statement. Whatever. But later I read an article about state-appointed lawyer. They are either freshly out of law school or the lawyers who cannot otherwise find a job. So they are not very qualified for that kind of trials to begin with. Those trials are very complex and very complicated, and they cannot defend those cases easily. So it's one of the legal problems in this country.
Can you talk about the committee?
Right after the trial, she didn't have any supporters, nor friends. But God must have been with her, because after 2.5 years since she was put in the prison, one of the Koreans got to know her case, and she talked to one of the Korean lawyers in that area, Raleigh. And this lawyer couldn't believe Mr. Seo, his name is Seo, and he couldn't believe it could have happened that way. So he visited Chongsun in prison and interviewed her, and then he decided to take upon the case. So he volunteered to work on the case and organized Korean community, and the Korean community has, especially churches in that area, have gotten together, and they submitted pardon petition to the governor, because the governor has executive clemency power. So it's in his hand now, and when we New York Free Friends campaign was formed in April this year, we didn't know in the past 2 years, we didn't know about the existence of the Raleigh group. But it was published in Raleigh, News and Observer, a major newspaper in the Raleigh area. And one of my friend's friends saw that article and sent it to my friend, who is a Caucasian woman who lived in Korea as a missionary for 25 years. And so she knows this problem, and she particularly ministered this kind of women in Korea for 6 years. So it was like she met one of her daughters when she saw this article. Oh, I know this problem. So she called me, and we formed a committee to help her out. So we went to Raleigh in April, this spring, April, to find the facts, what really happened. And we were convinced when we saw Chong Sung and all, we were convinced it didn't happen that way. She didn't kill her own son. She couldn't have killed her own son over, because son is very important. This son will be her master when she's old, and the son will feed her later in her life. So she couldn't have killed him instead of the Esther. So considering all this cultural background, we were convinced that it didn't happen that way, but she was wrongly accused. So we formed a committee and sent about 1,500 pieces of mail to the churches, Korean churches, and then also legal agencies in the United States. We sort of nationalized all the campaign. And the response was incredibly positive, especially from women, I mean, who had the slightest connection with Asian folks, who married to Asian man or had an Asian friend. Those were very convinced to support us, and they wrote lengthy letters describing how difficult to raise a child, and some of the women had very close experience to that incident and all this. So I was transformed by doing this action. I was transformed. I was broken up, literally broken up. When I heard this case, I couldn't function. I couldn't sleep for a whole week. I've never had such intense experience in my life. It was the first time. But I knew I would overcome. But in a week, I mean, I was just really just overwhelmed, but at the same time, empowered by Spirit, by God's presence during the time. And since that time, I just literally transformed. And I thought, why me? Why does God choose me to do this work? God could have chosen other people, could have touched other people to do, or pushed other people to do this work. Why me? And I was a little resentful at the same time, because it was so exhausting. But I didn't realize what kind of blessing it would be in the past. And since that time, I have been really blessed. And it really liberated me in many ways.
So the status of the case right now is that?
She will be pardoned very soon. Sure. I visited the governor. And beginning of May and beginning of June, we presented this case in the northeastern part of the United States, different churches. And one of them who heard this case volunteered to pay the expenses to fly one of the committee members down to the governor's office. And she met with the staff people, legal staff people of the office. And she is very close to be pardoned now. We are negotiating. There are two different pardons. One is forgiveness, and the other is by proving innocence. And we are trying to prove she is innocent. So we have to have a short or very
simple trial.
Hearing. Trial. Right.
In the governor's office is a special
hearing
that he can call to decide if the first trial was adequate or not. What the governor is afraid of and what he'd probably get is a lawsuit.
Right, against them.
For unlawful imprisonment.
Right, we might have to do it for the future. ACLU and American Friends Service Committee is advising us to file a lawsuit against the state of North Carolina. But I will find it out when I go back to New York.
Yeah. I just want to say that I'm married to a new person. We had 6.5 years of relative marital bliss.
That's what you call.
and then she had to go and change on me, and she used every word to describe her change except the Christian word conversion. But that, I think that's truly what has happened in her life, is that she is now converted. And it is not come in the usual way, but is still come in a very Christian kind of way that God often works in. And I guess the message, the lesson here for me is, I have to say it one more time as a recovering racist, is that we can talk in generalities all the time and speak about general problems, but when we get personally involved in a case of injustice, watch out. The truth will make you free and the truth will make you strange. And this is what's happened here. We've both been converted here about this. And it's been a very integral part of my life, providing support and I'm the liaison to the non-yellow community. And it's been quite a shakeup in our life.
Yeah, even our 5-year-old daughter said once, "Mom, I think I could see her face in my mind." One day she said that, and it really touched me. And she was helping us in a very unusual way. It really transformed our family.
Yeah,
I'm sure you have some questions. And
do you have a sense of your vision and direction after Chung Sun gets pardoned?
Right, in terms of her life?
No, your
life. My life, both ways. I'm really glad to talk about it. We are in the process of making a concrete plan what we are going to do for her when she gets out of prison. a lot of people in this country, like prison population is very high in this country, 1 in 100 people. 1% of the whole population is in prison. I don't think United States citizens are more inclined to be criminal than any other country's citizens. It's just the system, and it's the way it is here, unfortunately. So these people, the prison inmates, when they are released, they are having tremendous problem in terms of social skills and other skills, a job and all this. So we are in the process of getting her out and then put her in a somewhat protected neighborhood through counseling and all this. As for me, I have been toying with the idea of going back to school after he finished his PhD. I thought I would do counseling for minority women. It has been my interest in the past 5 years or so since I came to the United States. Just because of the language and cultural ignorance, a lot of good number of women, minority women, get in trouble and get caught in the system. So, but this particular incident has transformed me so that I could pursue my career more effectively or efficiently. So I'm going to law school. To just particularly to work for minority women, because I think minority women advocacy is very critical in this country.
Who has been looking after her daughter?
A daughter, I believe a social worker has taken her, but I don't know physically where she is and how often she gets to see her biological father. I don't know. We are going to find that out, because it was only 3 months ago since we started working on this case, so we didn't get that far yet, because there were other critical problems we had to deal with.
You said her first daughter's with
the ex-husband, or we didn't know about the first marriage and then the child.
One thing I think that's important to just mention about the legal system in this country is that it really has always and continues to be based upon factual evidence only. Mm-hmm. Which takes into consideration no cultural and no cultural specificities.
Right.
And so, as you were telling the story, I can just see that the jury and the attorneys, including the defense attorney, dealing only with facts about what was discovered, a cleaned up scene, that they might have seen being a cover up, and a mother who left children unattended. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the kind of facts that in this legal system are very weighty against the person who's been charged. And I think that's one thing about the legal system in this country that really needs to be looked at closely is how it is that that it can start to include cultural factors.
That's
certainly
adequacy is so important.
Yeah.
I realized that while I was reading the transcript, there was a clear division between the cultures. A Chinese doctor testified, who was a pediatrician of these two children. He testified in favor of her, very much so. because he examined them like a couple of weeks before the incident, and he didn't notice any abuse done by her. And she was affectionate and just normal, her. And then the owner of the bar, the store, testified. He was, I believe, Thai, and he was testified very favorably of her. As a matter of fact, since she got the job as a bartender, she borrowed a typewriter to practice. In that situation, I was so touched. She borrowed the typewriter to get a better job, and she started practicing. And in 2 weeks, she was in charge of the cashiers. So she was working very hard, but the system really didn't work out for her.
Let me try to put this comment into context, because it may be a little controversial here. I've done multicultural training for the last almost 20 years of my life. My youngest son is from Korea. Mm-hmm. As I heard you telling the story, one of the things that I've discovered, and it's a balance for me, and that's what I'm going to try to achieve in this discussion, that sometimes in our desire to become, and our responding to our recovering sexism or racism, I think sometimes I find myself not raising tough questions with people of color, mm-hmm. not raising questions with women, because I don't want to appear racist
right,
or sexist.
Right, uh-huh.
So the question I have, if I was just looking at this case as objectively as humanly
right.
possible,
mm-hmm.
I see a negligent mother.
Oh, yes.
I see a negligent
yes.
parent.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And,
very.
Very. So what is Chong, in your mind, accountable for in the death of a child? And
she is accountable for her
sure.
for the dead.
So, and it strikes me it's to work for a pardon,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure there'd be the same energy around working for a pardon for, a Caucasian woman caught in the same trap
uh-huh.
because she might know
right.
the system. So
mm-hmm.
I'm struggling with this a little bit, because clearly she's accountable,
mm-hmm.
even beyond the cultural values of not
mm-hmm.
Trusting white men, and given
mm-hmm.
her history, I can see why she wouldn't.
Right.
But to leave two children at that age unattended, I'm not sure I'd want anybody to be jailed for that.
Right.
But what is her accountability in your perspective for that?
She is definitely accountable for her own child's death, but she could have been convicted of highest, probably involuntary manslaughter.
Negligent homicide,
right.
which is not second-degree murder.
Yeah, it is, but she was not convicted of that. And it's very, probably extremely serious child abuse, you can think of. But I'm not defending for her behavior,
mm-hmm.
but she was driven, or she was forced to take a job at night to support the children. It is criminal enough.
Yeah, the point that really struck me in this conversation was your comment that, we rely on a system of information that says all truth is measurable and observable,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, a lot of truth is subjective, and the
right.
only way I can really try to understand you is to get to know you as a person.
Uh-huh.
And that's not really true in this case, but it makes me think about all, legal case that we need laws in order to have safe and respectable cultures to live in. But we also need relationships and understanding, and none
right.
of that is really allowed for in any court case.
Right, right. There are a lot of prison inmates who are innocent in this country. And I don't know how many people are innocent among 2,000 people who are on death row, but you might read an article in a paper sometimes, and there is a special ministry in New Jersey, in Princeton area, Centurion Ministry, which was started by a minister. And what's his name? Forget.
He deals specifically with death row.
He was a pastor for many years, and then also a business person to start off this ministry. But while he was in the seminary, he visited the prison, and a lot of prison inmates came to him and said, "Listen, please look into my file. I am innocent. I didn't commit a crime. I am innocent." So he looked into their files and realized some of them were innocent. So that's how his ministry started.
I believe that.
Right.
There's a task that you're taking here that you kind of loosely. You know, it just kind of set off a bell in my head, and the question is basically, you know, was this woman negligent or not? You know, does she deserve a pardon, this sort of stuff? And, you know, maybe there's some room for exploration there. How negligent was she in terms of her behavior? I have had a student of mine in the past 3 or 4 years, a young woman, Caucasian woman, trying to get through school under some very difficult circumstances. She became pregnant right out of high school from her boyfriend. They decided they didn't much care for the idea of each other after she became pregnant. So I wouldn't say it's just a case of her boyfriend ran off and left her, but they certainly parted.
Sure.
And her family basically disowned her as a result of that. Her parents refused to let her come back to the house and instructed her other two sisters not to let her back in the house. And this young girl was basically entirely on her own with the child.
Mm-hmm.
Worked part-time, was trying to go through school part-time. Trying to have the state pick up, you know, the safety net where at all possible. And her daughter, who's now about 6 years old, born with some chronic respiratory problems that nobody realized quite how serious they were at the time. It turns out the girl, just about 6 months or so ago, had to go in for some emergency surgery in a Dallas hospital to correct a breathing problem that was chronic. It had been with her since birth and had resulted in a slow and progressive oxygen deprivation that has left her permanently learning disabled, will leave her permanently less than a fully functional person in society. And this woman is flatly devastated by all of this and talking about, my gosh, you know, I've done this to my child.
All right.
What is the extent of her negligence in this? I've seen this woman for the past 4 or 5 years working harder than any other person I know to try and do all of this work. And in just a horrendously difficult position. And I would suspect that Chong Sun is sitting here in much the same kind of thing.
Right.
She's an Asiatic woman in this country who doesn't speak English very well. Her opportunities, where's her net? How much of this responsibility for negligence is...
She still thinks that she killed him. She doesn't say it. She explained, "I don't mean I killed him. Who would kill?" I mean, she cannot believe anybody could kill her their own children. She couldn't believe it. But she said, "Listen, what do you mean?" I asked her, and she said, "Listen, I went to work for them, but I ended up, it ended up killing Moses. So I didn't work. I mean, it was not for them, it was for me. I mean, I exist now, but he's gone. So she still feels very guilty.
It's pretty universal, I think, that women are in this double bind of if you stay at home with your children and you're a single parent, draw AFDC, well, you're negligent towards the government. You're sapping the government, you're using the government. And if you struggle against insurmountable cause, well, you're negligent somehow else. Yeah. And this is what women live with day in and day out.
Right.
I think it's what parents live with. Yes, and I...
No, more women, I'm sorry, but parents when you have it too, but that's not the common family combination.
Sure, but I just want, and I'm just speaking, you know, I don't want to be excluded from the conversation. I'm not denying that women aren't, but as a parent, I mean, I struggle with that as well. When we adopted our second son, we were in a situation where that adoption cost us $6,000. I was a graduate student at the time, and my income was $5,000. You know, so, and we went through a couple of years of a very challenging economic times, during which time my wife was also a student, and we were trying to balance the role of parent. So I'm trying to raise a delicate point here without trying to appear overtly sexist or racist, although.
And I'm not calling you sexist by that, but I'm just saying, and I guess people in this room are aware of this, but I, you know, just that there's so many single women out there who are trying very hard.
See, I think there's a point beyond this, and maybe that's where I'm trying to get to. And, you know, what made me think of when you asked your question is that, you know, what's really the issue here for me is the community. You know, when a child is baptized in our church, part of the ceremony is that I welcome that child into the family of God. And in that ceremony, I take on responsibility in relation to that child's life. And that, yet we live in a community where individualism and the breakdown of the family and isolation is such that, I mean, that someone said to me the other month, it's almost as like the best comparison to the church in this day is the church of the first century, you know, where people were hungry and people were homeless and people were starving. And Christians were known by how well they loved each other, how well they loved the stranger. And to me, you know, the child can't be their own advocate. And what the parent needs to do, at least, whether mother or father, is to be the advocate for the child, to help the community to see that they are accountable in this child's life. You know, if Chong Sung France is in a position where she can't fully meet the needs of that child, that's not a crime. You know, it is a crime if the community says, tough beans, we're not going to help. I mean, the child's, you know, in Chong Sung or whoever, I think does have a role of advocate in relation to that child to ask the community to be accountable for that life.
So you're assuming, you're making an assumption there that the child should be challenged a little bit, and that is that as a white person, you have a community here in this country which you feel probably somewhat comfortable with. But for the question is, who was Chong Sung's community? And if she was suspicious, and if she had had some very bad experiences,
and I would say her
community
church,
might have been limited.
And I think her church is in part accountable.
Her church,
she was a member of the church. How did they not know that she was a single parent living in a situation, having two jobs, and see, I hold the church for not knowing their parishioners well enough to know that somebody could be in that circumstance and nobody from the church responded. That's a sort of omission as far as I'm concerned.
But she had been in that community just 2 months when the incident happened.
She was new in the community.
And it was a military town.
Right.
So you have that kind of mentality going on. And I don't know if there was, if she was involved in a church at the time.
Before she left Aberdeen, Maryland, she was attending church and
the
church regularly, right?
See, I think
The church didn't like that kind of women to begin with. So that's why I thought I would just bring this up here, because there are a lot of church related people here, pastors and religious lay leaders. And some churches are not welcoming this kind of group. They don't want to hear about it.
And she, oh yeah, basically she was a prostitute. So yeah. how does the church you go to handle that?
Just read Hosea. I mean, so for me, I mean, the issue here, and I'm glad we got to it, is that somebody's accountable for the child's life.
Right.
And, you know, for the courts to put it all on child, we were saying it's a travesty of justice, and I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would love to have a discussion at some point, you know, with members of that church to say, how could Chong fall through the cracks here?
Well,
and to go back to my church and say, who's yeah. falling through the cracks in my church?
Well, the way the governmental system works now that does deal with this issue is that if this child would have been school age and if it would have had a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and that teacher, through their
yeah.
professional, you know, responsibility
yeah.
is
mm-hmm.
legally responsible
mm-hmm.
for making a phone call, one phone call
right.
to the Department for Health and Human Welfare if they suspect there's any abuse going on at home.
Right.
Also her doctor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The pediatrician would
right.
also fall into that professional
right.
ethics,
right.
so would the pastor.
Yeah.
Those who are bound in right. professionally to that system. So, but this child is not school age.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Right.
There was no pastor.
Maybe you have a birth certificate.
Okay. There was no pastor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Who else would there have been in their lives that would have been legally? I mean,
mm-hmm.
the people
right.
like this bartender who's saying
right.
who's defending her was probably also defending himself because
right.
for him to say,
yeah, right. yeah.
I suspect there was any abuse going on,
mm-hmm.
would have brought him into a situation
right.
of not ever raising
right.
concern.
Right. Of course.
Same thing with the pediatrician. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he could have been covering for himself in a significant way by saying, when they came to visit, you know, when they came for their hospital, their office visit, I didn't see anything going
mm-hmm.
on that was
mm-hmm.
at all suspicious because he legally
mm-hmm.
would have been a person in place
mm-hmm.
to raise
right.
those concerns.
Right.
So there could have been a lot of other factors going
mm-hmm.
on with
right.
their defense of
yeah.
her.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is that there might not have been those people in place in their lives that would have been connecting links to a greater system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just 2 months.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. I would like to point though about, you know, we may be well past time with the revenue individualists.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, right.
It's a time for a paradigm shift
mm-hmm.
and a call to a different type of community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what speaks to me here is that it's
sure
the loss of a child
yeah.
is really not a person's
right.
the responsibility,
mm-hmm.
but the community is
right. mm-hmm.
One part of the community we haven't discussed, that's the criminal justice system. And I think it's really easy to say, well, we, you know, we can blame the system. We can
you
blame
want to tell
the police
what part
officers.
Of the system you're in?
I work for sheriff's office. From a cultural standpoint, the criminal justice system is not educated whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And we're educated from the standpoint of collecting evidence and presenting evidence in court.
Right.
And that circumstantial evidence is what the courts rely upon to
right.
convict or to pardon someone.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, I can't defend South Carolina law or
mm-hmm.
I don't have anything to do with that, but seems to me that there was a definite mistrial there.